The Rolling Stones in mono is the full studio account of the first decade of one of the most influential bands in music history.
Just doing the best you can and putting everything you've got into it and hoping people will like it. There's no real secret to that.
Remastered onto vinyl and CD, this box set covers the Stones from their self-titled 1964 debut through to the decade-ending Let It Bleed.
It's good music, and everybody's had a good feeling when they hear it, when they grow up with it, and I guess we're just part of the furniture, you know?
The Rolling Stones in mono is out now.
This Day in Music Radio. Documentaries. An in-depth look at some of the most important musicians in the history of music.
You are listening to part two of The Rolling Stones in mono. Their debut album, The Rolling Stones, England's Newest Hitmakers, was released in 1964. Within a year, they would be worldwide musical stars. Here is Andrew Lou Goldham.
It was an era of opportunity because you put out a single every 12 weeks, an album every 4 months,
right.
You'd think that people would forget about us, that would be our last hit. That was the mentality, wasn't it?
Once you were having hits, you know, you had to have another one in 12 or 14 weeks. There was no time to crow and relax over satisfaction, say, going to, like, number one in 38 countries, because in 12 weeks you had to have, you know, a follow-up or you know, and four albums. It was wonderful.
Did you have any idea of how far it would or could go?
No. I mean, anybody who's listening to us was the age that we were then knows very well that you don't really, your mind is not on anything but getting around the next corner safely.
Here is photographer Gerard Mankiewicz, who was the band's go-to picture taker.
I met them at the end of 64 and I first shot with them at the beginning of 65. Satisfaction hadn't come out yet.
Right. Which changed things.
Completely.
So
it was very much still, when I first worked with them, Brian Jones was still probably the sort of preeminent...
His band.
Still probably his band. I mean, I'm sure there was discussion.
I'm sure.
You know, this was an extraordinary period for youth, for energy, for new ideas. And it was exciting to be part of that, even though one had no sense that it was going to change history. It was just exciting to be part of that.
The Stones would embark on what can only be described as an extraordinary run of extraordinary pop singles. Here is music historian and author Harvey Kubinick.
They didn't have that major support that the Beatles had, you know, with their record label. And they weren't playing to a lot of full houses at all. And they actually, you know, were on these package shows on that 64 tour. And so to cheer the band up, he made a call to Phil Spector, and then Phil Spector helped him out a bit to record the group at Chess Records in Chicago, which is sort of like going into Buckingham Palace if you want royalty or something.
And also Phil Spector was involved in recording the debut album, England's Newest Hitmakers, in 64.
The group went to Chess Records and probably did 15 sessions there, or, you know, 15 sides in a few days of recordings, which really helped their spirits, and they cut a bunch of tracks there. And then they came to Hollywood, and that was their recording home from pretty much after the first album, from 1964 to 67.
I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day.
Andrew Lou Goldham.
We were very lucky because as we were independent people and we weren't signed direct to Decca and we could make our records wherever we wanted, nobody could stop us recording quasi-illegally in America as long as we had enough bodyguards on the door to keep the Musicians Union of America out. And, you know, so we weren't having Decca. We weren't signed the way... I mean, and hey, you get what you deserve. If the Beatles had been recording anywhere else than with the wonderful team of engineers, producers, and they were blessed, man. You know, and some of their engineers were also musicians. You know, they were surrounded by a great team, so it really worked for them. It didn't work for, it wouldn't have worked for the Rolling Stones, working in that sort of turret-type mentality where you might be allowed to hear the work you've done. So when we decided we wanted to work in America, there was nobody to stop us. So the Rolling Stones, in many ways, were... It's not so much they made it in America, but not only by the music, but by the experience, they were made by America in that we got the opportunity to work there. And when we turned up, first of all, at Chess Studios, and then later where we did so much work at RCA in Hollywood, they're not ashamed of the music. You know, the engineers and the studio people, they're not, oh, God, I worked with that scruffy lot today. It was like, welcome to the club. We make music. We like American pop music. And you didn't really have that in England. Well, I've told you once and
I've told you twice. The first Jagger Richards composition to reach number one in the UK charts was The Last Time, released in February of 1965. It went top 10 in America. Johnny Marr.
My own personal favourite Rolling Stones single or song would be, there's a lot of them, of course, but my favourite would be The Last Time. Well, this could be the last time. This could I think it's, as every time I've ever heard it from being a little kid, I want to hear it, the rest of it when it comes on. I'm never bored of it. Partly it's to do with the sound of that guitar riff, which is just amazing. It just kind of sums up that period for me really well, and I don't think there's another band who sound like it. It's also, interestingly, a song that mods can like and rockers can like too, which is quite interesting because it was done at a time when that kind of criteria was important. Well, this could be the last time. This could be
the last time. Maybe the last time. The group were completely at home working in American studios, and recording in mono, with stereo soon on the way, was a natural recording process. Here is Harvey Kubinick.
When the bands and the individuals first recorded, you know, in these studios, and we're talking specifically about the Stones box set, mono is how the bands recorded and heard the first playbacks of their work. Initially, you know, the capacity to record in that mono world was very limited. Things were often direct to two-track. There was a time where there were three-track recordings. And then the advent, obviously, of the four-track situation. So, you know, what you put down is what the bands heard, quick throw together by the producers or engineers. So the bands really were there for the mono stuff. And the stereo situation was almost an afterthought.
Within a few short years, the band had released six albums and a dozen hit singles. They were developing at breakneck speed. Here is Mick Jagger talking in 1965.
We've been making top 20 records in England for 2 years. Obviously, with all jazz stars, we're 2 years older than when we started off, so we obviously have developed in some way. We won't change our style, so... Just sort of one day to another, one day we decide we're going to do something different. It doesn't happen like
changes
that.
I don't gradually. Think we're changing our style so much as we're broadening our scope. I think we're Now we're sort of developing in lots of different directions musically.
In 1965, a breakthrough recording for the band was released. The songwriting skills of Jagger and Richards fused beautifully to produce one of the greatest songs of the 60s and one of the group's best ever. Recorded in May during the band's third North American tour, it spent 4 weeks at the top of the charts. The Stones stepped out from the Beatles' shadow. It was their first international number one and established the band as a worldwide premier act. Here is Gerard Mankiewicz.
It was a very exciting period to be working. It was an amazing business to be working in. Mm. It was stimulating. It was thrilling. It was fun. And for me, it had to be fun. We had to be having a good time and making what we thought were great images. I mean, that was the whole point of doing it, was I wanted to be an image maker to the music business. Mm. I wanted to work closely with these people and be part of them. And for me, with that, really, in America, I went to America with the Stones in 65. I toured America with them.
Wow.
And I mean, that was one of the most exciting periods of my life. And it was quite extraordinary.
Right, to be in the eye of the storm.
Absolutely. Mm. And of course, in those days, there was, you know, the access wasn't an issue. I mean, I was one of the band. I was on stage with them every night.
Yeah, almost the fifth member, sixth member.
Seventh, because Ian Stewart, the roadie, was always the sixth.
Right,
so maybe I could call myself the seventh.
Yeah, just
so,
for a moment,
brief moment.
Yeah, okay. So, Harvey Kubinick, we have what is quintessentially a British rock and roll record that's been made and constructed on the west coast of America. It's an American record by all intents and purposes.
Well, yes, I think that the song was kind of constructed, at least by Keith, in a Florida hotel room. I believe there was a version of it attempted at Chess Studios. Then all the fuzz tone stuff and everything. And remember, the Stones were buying equipment at Wallach's Music City out here. They used Fender amps out here. Sometimes they had some of their own gear that they would schlep in and use. So even the equipment, the boxes, the guitar strings, the physical guitars, the amplifiers and stuff like that, all were made and delivered, you know, by cartage to the recording studio, i.e. RCA Studios out here.
One young Irishman was totally enamoured with the Rolling Stones. Here is Bob Geldof.
Famous ones like Satisfaction, like I'm driving in my car, a man comes on the radio saying I can't be a man if I don't smoke the same cigarettes as him. Mm. I can't get satisfaction. He does talk about sexual satisfaction later, but he's talking about there is no satisfaction in having stuff. And you keep pumping this stuff at me. That's consumerism. No one had identified it. This kid did, you know, with this pendulous nose and mouth and floppy hair and all that.
Their most memorable hit is still as popular today as it was in 1965. It has been a staple of their shows for decades. Here is drummer Charlie Watts.
We have a bit of a problem there with doing tour, you know, when we tour, because you always think, oh, we'll make this one totally different. But of course, you do have to play Satisfaction. You don't have to, and you can miss it out. But generally, people would love to hear it. So it's quite difficult. And as the years have rolled by, as we say, we've done it in rehearsals. You know, you get like 60, we play 160 songs out of the 600 we've got. Rehearse them, not seriously. We play them. We don't actually rehearse them, we play them. Aren't interested in that. All they want to do is get down us to play Satisfaction.
Harvey Kubinick, we can talk about the recordings and the studios, but more importantly, the direction that Andrew gave the band, Andrew Lou Golden, with managing and producing them and organising them. He was the exception, wasn't he?
And more important, he also understood the engineer, the principal engineer, a fellow named Dave Hassinger, who was sort of the head engineer at RCA for a while. He also understood the heritage, both of them, Dave Hassinger and Andrew, of what RCA Studio was. I mean, Duke Ellington recorded, you know, Take the A-Train. Sam Cooke recorded at RCA. Henry Mancini, Peter Gunn, all these big records for years before were at RCA, which had the best collection of microphones. And Elvis Presley had recorded, you know, at RCA. So they walk into the studio, and Andrew knew the room a bit, and he knew the engineer had flexibility. It wasn't like the engineers in England that were really on the clock. The Stones would block book the studio for 2 weeks at a time. Up until then, literally, you had situations where you had 4 hours to cut a song or two, the way records used to be made. So mono was important, and 'cause the mixdowns were all in mono, and then the band would go socialize. Andrew was very involved with the mono process, and mic placement, and more important, Andrew, like with Satisfaction, took the master recording to a place in New York called Bell Sound to oversee the mastering with a guy named Big Dom there. So the mono process, very important.
Get Off of My Cloud was written as a follow-up single to the successful Satisfaction. The song topped the charts in the UK and America in 1965. Here is Neil Finn of Crowded House.
We didn't have many singles. We had a little record player, but we didn't have that many singles that I can remember. And I remember this one. I played it over and over and over again, and it was probably the first time I'd kind of been aware of a rockin' kind of... Well, anyway, I got a bit obsessed with it.
Great
record.
Fantastic.
Probably still
record.
My favourite Rolling Stones song of all time. I don't know all of the Rolling Stones records, so I'm not a devotee. But this song, just every time I hear it, it really evokes a lot of very old memories for me.
The album Aftermath was released in the spring of 1966 and was the first Rolling Stones album to be composed entirely of Jagger Richards' compositions. The album's opening track, Mother's Little Helper, was one of the first pop songs to address the issue of prescription drugs. Bob Geldof.
Jagger was in the London School of Economics. So this is the thing that you learn political history and economic theory there. He only went there, I think, for a year and a half. So here's a young guy, and like, he's uber sex god, and I absolutely think he is the ultimate front guy. There's never been anyone like him, and probably still isn't, and probably never will be.
Yeah.
And yet he's really acute at watching what's happening around him in society. And people forget that about this middle period Stones, before they invented rock music with Honky Tonk Woman and Jumpy Jack Flash and those ones. He's talking about the middle class experience of women suddenly being bored with their lot, as opposed to finding fulfillment in being the wife at home with the kids and the domesticity. Suddenly in the 60s, they were getting bored, but no one actually knew that. He spotted it. And what were they doing? They were turning to antidepressants in their millions. So you get Mother's Little Helper, which was our Prozac. It was Valium and Librium. And he's writing about what a drag it is getting old. You know, nothing achieved. Yeah. Here I am at home.
Kids are different today. I hear every mother say, mother needs something today to calm her down. And though she's not really ill, there's a little yellow pill. She goes running for the shelter of her mother's little helper, and it helps her on her way, gets her through her busy day.
The Beatles clearly were another thing going on altogether. This was a social phenomenon beyond the music. This was about something else happening, and critically important, and that was the breakdown of the class thing,
yeah.
And where accents and the way you looked meant more than how you were born. And then suddenly they turn out to be musical geniuses. You certainly wouldn't know that from the first album.
Mm.
And they exemplified, the four of them, a whole new way of thinking. Next behind them come these louts. This sort of brooding, sullen louts who never open their mouth, you know, who totally changed the, you know, you're not supposed to look like that. Just, you know, comb your hair. Like, you know, I can't even sing your song. And like, my old man was going, look at them, look at them. You know, I can't even whistle their tunes. And I was going, yes, you know. And then suddenly in their lyrics, they're challenging everything. Like, they're really aggressive in their music. It's the equivalent of the Clash and the Pistols. Yeah. That's what they were.
The Stones have been a huge influence on the Charlatans. His lead singer, Tim Burgess.
Jagger is not human. He is beyond human. I've seen him run around the stage. I've seen him close up, and he is just like beyond any other frontman ever. I mean, there's only him and Elvis Presley and men. Very influenced by Tina Turner, I would imagine. So he kind of drew from the best. Keith Richards as a guitarist is kind of like, if Jagger is full on and in your face and the ultimate showman, then Keith Richards is probably the complete opposite of that. A yin and yang combination, I would say. I'm sure he's not, but his persona is lazy, can't be arsed thing, whereas Jagger is showman, in your face, professional.
Singer Beth Orton would hear the Stones being played around the house as a child. She remembers hearing Under My Thumb for the first time.
Under
remember hearing around at my house with brother putting that on, because we lived in this house. He had the box room, and it was just like, oh, it was just beautiful. Anything he'd put on, the whole house could hit. Do you know what I mean? We'd all hit. We like might as well put it on in my room. So it's like, and that, I love the Rolling Stones, and that song in particular. I know it's as misogynist as they come, really. The message is revolting. Think about it, and well, we could go on and on about that. I mean, but what the hey? But this song, for the bass line, if nothing else, is cheeky. It's just, it's sort of like, it's misogynist, but at least I think he's got his tongue in his cheek.
The group's success on the British and American singles charts continued during 1966 with the blistering 19th Nervous Breakdown. Here is Liam Gallagher.
I preferred the Brian Jones era than all the smelly era, you know, when they all got a bit like glued their hair dead long and didn't wash and just. But no, I prefer that era, man. It's a lot more jolly.
Musician Johnny Marr of The Smiths looks back at the early to mid-period Stones with great admiration.
My favourite Stones period is the early to mid-60s, heyday, if you like.
I see a red door and I want it painted black. No colours anymore, I want them to turn black.
The run of singles that started with I Think It's All Over Now, and The Last Time, Get Off My Cloud, Satisfaction, 90th Nervous Breakdown. I mean, they're all just amazing 45s and great songs. Just such an interesting sound, really, and out there on their own. I don't think anyone else could have really done those songs. I think it's true that people could do versions of Beatles songs, not as well, not as definitive, but I'm not sure anyone could really do Rolling Stones songs. I think a lot of that is because of the way Mick Jagger sings. So he's, for some reason, people forget to give him the credit. He doesn't get the credit that he once had or deserves. And maybe that's part of becoming an institution or just being around for us so long. If you actually listen to what Mick Jagger's doing on those original records, you could argue really that they're the first punk rock singles. In terms of what the Rolling Stones meant during that period, they were definitely the first punk rock group, I think. And he was the first great frontman without a guitar, in a way. Mick Jagger was the first proper teenage rebel frontman, and I think without Jagger you wouldn't have Bowie, and without Bowie you wouldn't have John Lydon, and on it goes, really. So that early period of the Stones, I think, really set out what anti-pop chart music could really be in a rock and roll band.
As the band's worldwide popularity continued, Jagger, Richards and Jones were hounded by authorities over their recreational drug use in early 1967. News of the World ran a three-part expose entitled Pop Stars and Drugs, Facts That Will Shock You. After various incidents, three out of the five Rolling Stones now faced criminal charges. While awaiting the appeal hearings, the band recorded a new single, We Love You, as a thank you for the loyalty shown by their hordes of fans. Coming up in part three of The Rolling Stones in Mono.
Yeah, because you were brought up on the blues and all that, and that music is now, like I said, as old as that now. Do you think it has matured, and are you therefore a better player? Or?
Oh, that's for somebody else to say. I do my best. I still keep my hand in, you know.
And do you practice?
Not as much as I should, probably.
Join me for part three of The Rolling Stones in Mono at thisdayinmusic.com or download This Day in Music Radio on iTunes.
This Day in Music Radio. Documentaries. An in-depth look at some of the most important musicians in the history of music.
When we first started out, it was like we thought it might last at most 10 years.
It's just the truth is I have a soulful voice. It's all like done live. And I've kept it quite simple.
I had Dazed and Confused in the way that it's heard on the first album, that whole construction of it.
This Day in Music Radio. Documentaries.
For more information, go to thisdayinmusic.com.